You know, I for a long time, I have thought that the trajectory of human species is coming to a fork in the road. And I feel like two things are happening, you know, as you say, converging. One is that the technological development is accelerating and is fusing ever more profoundly with human consciousness in ways that I agree with you. I think we are screwing ourselves out of existence as a species because we're merging with technology. You know, it's already well underway. It's not something new. You know, I remember years ago thinking, why is Gmail free? Everyone's on Gmail. It's free. It's got to be costing them tons of money to run all these servers. Why is it free? Well, clearly it's because there's some value in amassing trillions of emails that their artificial intelligence can absorb and learn from, and not in some nefarious, like, learn our secrets and what porn sites you look at and all that kind of stuff, but how do we think? How do we talk? What comes next when this statement comes? What's the next statement? How is emotion expressed and hidden? And, like, it's studying us and has been for a long time. And so we are getting to a point where we will be either absorbed into the technology or disposed of by the technology when we've served our purpose.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Take a Deep Breath. My name is Mike Mayer. I'm a breath coach, and in this podcast, I get to interview people from all walks of life, mostly around breath work, but often we talk wellness and we talk relationships and so many things. And it is with my great pleasure to reintroduce you, or to bring back onto the show, Dr. Chris Ryan. Dr. Chris Ryan wrote a book called Sex at Dawn, and then his follow-up book was called Civilized to Death. And I highly recommend you check those books out. They completely shifted my thinking on so many different things. And I've been a fan of Chris's for a while. His podcast, Tangentially Speaking, literally changed my life. And I heard him talking about his travels to India in the 80s and all these journeys he went on. The guests that he's had from all walks of life are just an incredible podcast. It's my favorite show, obviously, after this, after the breathcast. But it's my favorite show. And in this podcast, we speak about a number of things. But in particular, I wanted to get his opinion on AI, where we're heading, what that impact is going to be like for sex and sex robots and relationships and different things there. Also talk about our hunter-gatherer ancestors and how their lives are and were different from the lives that we live now, me being on this screen talking to you, sitting down at this desk. And so it's just a wonderful conversation that we have around a number of things. And so I hope you just sit back and relax and enjoy his voice and enjoy this conversation. Before we begin, I have one thing for you. One little question. Wherever you are listening to this, watching this, could you click the follow or subscribe button? Please. It really helps us grow this community and means that we can get more guests on like Chris. So enjoy the show. Cheers. It's wonderful to have you back on the show. I just want to get stuck straight in. I've got so many, my mind's just been going off on all these different tangents, Chris. You said something on the podcast ages ago and I couldn't find it. And it was something like, I'm going to butcher it now. He said, there's three things you should tell your partner. And one of them was, I think it was like, tell them that they're beautiful. Can you remember, what were those three things? Because they were gold and I should have wrote them down at the time. Does that ring any bells for you? One was like, you spoke to some girls in your past and you said, and one of your girlfriends said, I've never been told I was beautiful before, or something like that. Does that ring any bells?
Vaguely. But I mean, the reason I do the podcast is so I don't need to remember what I said, you know, just leave it with technology. But yeah, I do have some vague memory of talking about how surprised I've been with women that I've been in relationships with who've told me, like, you know, that no man has ever, like, complimented me in a meaningful way before. And I just thought, like, that's such a sad state of affairs, because if you're in a relationship with someone, presumably you appreciate them, right? I mean, that's why you want to spend your life with them. And to be cheap about affection and admiration and, you know, expressions of these feelings that clearly you're having serves no one. It's a strange thing that I think we do for some reason in Western cultures anyway. It doesn't really make sense because, I mean, I understand from an emotional perspective, there's vulnerability involved in having that kind of generous praise of someone else because, you don't want to lose it. And so when you express how much you value it, there's always going to be that other side of the coin that, there's vulnerability there. But I think that a lot of people feel safer if they can sort of denigrate the person they're in a relationship with because they feel like if they praise the person's going to start thinking, well, maybe I can do better, you know? Like they'll get, their ego gets pumped up and then they're going to want to leave you if you are open with her about how wonderful she is. So that cheapness, that emotional stinginess is really an expression of her own insecurity, you know, that if you knew how great you were, you would dump me. You know, and we hear that all the time in popular culture. How many songs are, you know, what's a girl like you doing with a guy like me? You know, like you're so much better than me. So I think we need to sort of deal with our own shit. And that liberates us to be more generous with those around us.
Yeah. Well, any thoughts on like how hunter-gatherers would communicate? I forget if this was in your book, but did they talk about like how communicative they were with each other about feelings, emotions, and those sort of things? Or do we have any knowledge on that now?
Well, the only knowledge we would have on anything like that would be from contemporary hunter-gatherers, right? And that's an aspect of life that I think is not really, you can't really extrapolate from contemporary groups. That's one of the challenges of the kind of writing I've done and research I've done about prehistory, that there are different sources of data that, you can look at, ranging from archaeology to primatology to human anatomy, and that there are all sorts of different perspectives that converge on a particular vision of how people lived. And contemporary hunter-gatherers and anthropological research is one of those sources of information, but it's limited in some ways. And I think something like this, like how people communicated, is going to be an area that isn't really open to that sort of extrapolation. We don't know. We don't even know when language evolved in our species, right? Because there's no anatomical evidence for language that fossilizes. You know, the vocal cords don't fossilize. So you can't really look at archaeological dig from 200,000 years ago and determine, did these people talk? You know, to what extent did they talk? Was there grammar, or was it just, you know, grunting indications of pleasure or pain or, you know, annoyance or whatever? Like, we really don't know. We know that there was rapid expansion of brain capacity at one point, which, at several points, but around 70,000 years ago, there appears to have been an expansion of brain capacity, which a lot of people theorize coincided with a great kind of cultural expansion. And some people think that is when language became more sophisticated and social integration grew rapidly in its complexity. But that's all conjecture. Nobody really knows. So, yeah, it's interesting. Hunter-gatherer groups, contemporary hunter-gatherer groups, to my knowledge, aren't very, they're pretty practical in terms of their relation with sexuality and relationships. It's either working or it isn't. It's good or it's not. I remember reading somewhere, I don't remember where this was, but it might have been in a book called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, which is just a fantastic book I go back to often, written by linguist Daniel Everett, who lived with the Pinaha people in the upper Amazon, who are a very interesting, unique kind of hunter-gatherer group. Anyway, I think it was in that book, and he was talking about how he took a couple of them from the jungle into town. I think it was for like a medical emergency or something. So he was in a village in Brazil with some of these people from the jungle, and they understood some Portuguese, and they heard a radio, and they were like, why are these people always singing about love, 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 love? What are they, children? Like, what, you know, they saw that as that sort of romanticism as being very kind of infantile and unevolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're craving it. And so we have to say, yeah, interesting that. I just finished a documentary series called Ring of Fire. Have you come across this?
I don't think so. Five-part
series. It was over a decade, and it was filmed in the 70s and 80s. It was all around Indonesia. Oh, you would love it.
About Indonesia. Yeah, was it the two brothers who were traveling around?
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Yeah, I actually watched that in Bali. One of the brothers is still alive.
Yes.
And I was going to have him on the podcast. Yeah. I was corresponding with him, but he was traveling. He wasn't around. And the other brother had died a couple of years earlier. And he was walking down the street, and he, you know, in lots of places in Southeast Asia, they're just like holes in the sidewalk. Yeah. And he just fell into one of the holes and broke his leg. And then it got infected, and he died. This guy who'd had these crazy adventures, right? Yeah. Like these two guys going all around. Yeah, that's an amazing documentary. I really enjoyed it.
Incredible.
That.
Yeah, it's so I was going to say you should get him on. I had him on a couple of weeks ago, Lawrence.
Oh, really?
And just wow. I could have spent hours talking to him. He'd just been hanging out with who's the guy that directs Titanic? Cameron, what's his name? Him.
Oh, James Cameron.
You know, he's connected to everybody, clear this guy. He's the guy you want to talk to at the party. And but yeah, he told the story of his brother. Like me and my brother, there's one point in the documentary picks up this deadly octopus, and they're just like filming it and playing with it. And I think it was Richard Attenborough watches the rushes back going, you know, that's like one of the most deadly octopuses in the world. And then, yeah, his brother just fell down a manhole cover, got an infection and passed away. But there was a bit in one of the films where they're in Papua New Guinea and they're with their ex-headhunters that have still remember the taste of human flesh, some of the older ones, and it looked really barbaric there. It was very muddy, and there was a lot of like kind of infighting going on and stuff, and I said, was there any love there, was there anything else, was there much play? And he said it was all love and play, but we only had like a few minutes of tape, you know, it's the 70s, got these big camcorders, so we just filmed the most dramatic bits. He goes, but there was, what you didn't see was like lots of love and generosity, and quite different from what you see on the screen. I don't know where I was going with this, other than it was a really good documentary about not hunter-gatherers, but about these quite isolated tribes. But yeah, he was an interesting dude. He also told me something. He said that I'm still waiting for him to explain this. He's going to send me an email. He likes to play with being put under. So when he goes under general anesthetic for operations, he likes to explore what's on the other side. And I'm really gutted that I didn't dig into that more with him, but he says he's going to give me a summary on that as well. But yeah, if you get the chance now, he's in Bali. You can do it on Zoom. He's a wonderful guest, Chris. So yeah, I highly recommend him.
Yeah.
Cool. So there's a few bits I really want to pick your brain on today. And one is this whole AI thing that's happened over the last 12 months. It seemed like this ChatGPT was launched on 30th. Obviously, it's been a long time coming. There's been years of research and development and stuff. I keep seeing these things about AI girlfriends, sex bots. It feels like everything's merging. I jokingly said to my friends, you know, we're going to screw ourselves out of existence soon. You're going to get this perfect bot that knows exactly, it's got your heart rate monitor on. It knows exactly what tone of voice you want. It might even be a bit cheeky or a bit rude with you because that's what you like. Where do you think we're going with this AI thing? What are your thoughts on it from what you've seen so far? I'm just going to cut to the chase. If you're looking to reduce stress and anxiety, deepen your own breathwork practice, connect with like-minded people, come and give us a try in our community. This isn't a sad Facebook group. This is a vibrant place on a platform called School. It's the up-and-coming place for all things communities. And I'm in there breathing live almost every single day. People are coming to me because it's the accountability. We're holding each other accountable. We're doing the breath work. Each month, we do a completely new module based on something to do with the breath and mind and body. And I'm bringing in expert guests. We've already had some wonderful breath celebrities come in and teach us some things about breathing. So why not sign up now? There's a 7-day money back promise if you don't like what's in there. My goal is for you to fall in love with us in this community. So the link is down below. Hope to see you in there. Let's get back on with the podcast.
Well, okay. First of all, I'm no expert. So, you know, there are millions of people who know more about this than I do. So that I just need to begin with that. But I for a long time, I have thought that the trajectory of the human species is coming to a fork in the road. And as I don't know, in the UK, if you guys have these Yogi Berra quotes. Do you know who Yogi Berra was? He was a baseball coach, I think. Not Yogi the Bear. Like that's
what I thought you meant, yeah.
Right, no. His name is Yogi Berra. I think he was a baseball coach. And he was famous for saying things, kind of obvious things, but in a memorable way. Like, I think he was talking about a baseball game and he said, "It ain't over till the fat lady sings," you know, an opera reference. That's, you know, now everyone says that and has no idea where it came from. But anyway, one of his quotes was, he said, "When you come to a fork in the road, take it." It's like, it makes no sense, but it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And I feel like humanity is coming to a fork in the road, and I feel like two things are happening, you know, as you say, converging. One is that the technological development is accelerating and is fusing ever more profoundly with human consciousness in ways that I agree with you. I think we are screwing ourselves out of existence as a species because we're merging with technology. And, you know, it's already well underway. It's not something new. You know, why is, you know, I remember years ago thinking, why is Gmail free? Like, why are they... Everyone's on Gmail. It's free. It's got to be costing them tons of money to run all these servers. Why is it free? Well, clearly it's because there's some value in amassing trillions of emails that their artificial intelligence can absorb and learn from. And not in some nefarious, like, learn our secrets and what porn sites you look at and all that kind of stuff, but how do we think? How do we talk? What comes next when this statement comes? What's the next statement? How is emotion expressed and hidden? And, like, it's studying us and has been for a long time. And so, you know, the powers that be will always point to the beneficial effects of that, right? Like, oh, but, you know, it can develop cures for disease and you can have your, you know, internet communications and podcasts recorded remotely around the world and blah, blah, blah. It's all, everything's so great. But what's really happening, I think, is that humanity is a larval stage of life. And our destiny is to give birth to another form of life, which is all around us right now, but we still are having trouble recognizing it. And it's super organisms like corporations and institutions of various types that sort of absorb us and absorb our energy and our intelligence and use it for their own purposes, which are often in opposition to ours, which is why we get fired and screwed out of our retirement. And, you know, we're disposable. We already know we're disposable to institutions. And then I think that's also happening with technology. And so we are getting to a point where we will be either absorbed into the technology or disposed of by the technology when we've served our purpose. So I think that's going up. One fork is going in that direction. And the other fork is that we seem to be on the verge of collapse, you know, at all times. And so it feels like it's this kind of, it's a race between escape velocity on one side, where we become technology and leave behind our biological necessities for clean water and clean air and, you know, a sort of biological context in which we can thrive or even survive. And on the other side, the whole thing just sort of collapses and we regress. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, but we return to a much more human way of living, right? Which is what I write about in Civilized to Death, where, you know, we return to a way of living that actually is responsive to our needs as human beings, as Homo sapiens, and is much more in alignment with our nature as animals. Which way it's going to go, I don't know, but I think it could go both ways is what I'm thinking. Like on one side, we could have, you know, we could sort of split into two existences, one of which goes off to the stars, you know, or Mars or whatever, as a half biological, half technological being, or others get left behind, but left behind in something that is more similar to hunter-gatherer groups that are codependent and are interdependent and return to a more sort of primordial way of life, which could sound apocalyptic to a lot of people. But I think, you know, one of the strains of propaganda that we're all subject to is this idea that when civilization breaks down, things are horrible. And, you know, that we should be grateful for civilization and all the trappings and comforts of civilization, which we're all very familiar with. And so if those things go away because of economic collapse or revolution or, you know, solar flare from the sun that wipes out electrical substations all over the world or whatever it is, then, you know, we're going to be fucked because we won't have all our comforts and so on. What's interesting is that when collapse happens, often people look at that as the best times of their lives, right? They look back and they say, wow, that's when we took care of each other, you know, right after 9/11 or right after the flood or right after, you know, the invasion or the earthquake or whatever it is. People often look at that period of their lives and say, that's when there was meaning. That's when I felt part of a community. That's when strangers took care of each other. And, you know, similar to what you mentioned in Papua New Guinea, there was love everywhere, right? There was play everywhere. There was also disaster. There was also suffering, but there's suffering right now. We just don't see it. We sweep it under the rug. send it to the old folks' home, send it to the hospital, send it to the, you know, industrial chicken factory, keep it out of sight, right? And what happens when the system breaks down is the suffering is no longer hidden, and we see it and we experience it, but that also stimulates us to take care of one another. I mean, I just wrote about this on my Substack a couple of days ago. There's a fantastic book called A Paradise Built in Hell by Rebecca Solnit, where she looks at disaster sociology and interviews people who spend their lives studying human behavior in disasters. And what they found is that people behave typically the opposite of what we're told they would do. So it's not looting and pillaging and raping and murdering and all that when the structures of authority are gone. What happens is people rise up and take care of one another. And there's a really powerful quote from the founder of the discipline of disaster sociology, paraphrasing him, but he says something like, you know, after spending my life investigating this, I've realized that we have it backwards. The disasters are the things, there are the times that people remember as being the best times of their lives, because it provides a relief from the real disaster, which is daily life.
You reminded me of, is it Sebastian Junger's book, Tribe, if you come across that book?
Sure, yeah, it's a great book.
Yeah, that was not, I think he talks about 9/11 in there, and I think he says antidepressant prescriptions dropped and suicides dropped in the weeks after 9/11 in New York. And yeah, he talks about community and neighbors cooking for each other and all those sort of things. Yeah,
right. And look at what's going on.
There's something's missing.
Right. Look at those very things, you know, anxiety, depression, suicide. Those are all going up rapidly in teenagers starting around 2012, which is the introduction of the smartphone, right? So what does the smartphone do? It puts you alone in your room rather than out with friends, right? Out in the world. No, it puts you in a virtual world where your interactions are all mitigated by technology, by capitalism, by devices that are designed to suck your attention, right? Suck it right out of your life. What do we have? That's all we have. That's what life is made of, attention, right? It's hours of attention. That's what our lives are. And yeah, these parasites are designed to, you know, just extract that attention away from us in ways that are ever more efficient and inescapable. And so our spirits and our bodies rebel, right? Even if they can convince our brains that it's good, our bodies know better. Just like, you know, advertising convinces people that cheese puffs are good food, but your body's like, no, your body doesn't buy it. Your body rebels, right? So I think that's what's happening. I think there's this divergence between what, the superorganism, the matrix, whatever you want to call it, convinces us is good for us, our Instagram accounts and our TikTok viewing and our blah, blah, blah. And yet the spirit is rebelling and people are killing themselves or finding life intolerable because that's not what life is supposed to be like.
Yeah. So as we spoke before, hit record, I'm now a father of a 1 year old. So that whole first year has just been mental in a good way and a crazy way. And it's by the way, on this quick side note, it's interesting how the brain changes. And I was just saying this to somebody yesterday, actually. It's like when he was born, it's like, oh, I'm no longer the main character in the story. It's now him. It was a really interesting shift. And now everything in me is like, don't die. Not because I don't want to die. It's like, don't die because of him. Everything kind of shifted, which is wonderful. all this stuff kicked in. We've decided to go like screen free with him. And that sounds like quite easy. It's really fucking hard to do. So we've like, initially it was like, oh, we can watch TV because he can't turn his head. So we would like watch a bit of TV at night and he was asleep in Nina's arms. And eventually he was like turning the TV. So the TV then has to go off. And then later on, he noticed we were on our phones and he would like just stop and stare at you. So then the phone's gone away. So there was like this withdrawal symptom we had. It's like, what the hell are we going to do with our evenings and weekends? And then it's like, oh, you play with your kid and you're in the real world. And again, it sounds so obvious now, but I think having my head in that phone for the last, 15, 20 years, it's taken a year for it to start to pull out. And now the evening is, there's no TV. We're downstairs playing with his little trucks and his toys and, you know, messing about. And before you know it, 3 hours have gone by. But I can't understand what that was like before, because I've seen those stats. I've seen the suicide stats for the teenagers and stuff. It's fucking terrifying. So it's we're trying to do this, not ancestral living, because that's quite an extreme version of it, but we're trying to get as close to nature as we can. So daylight, movement, breath work, whole dog. Foods, getting him chewing, all these different things. It's a trip, man. It's a proper trip. Where do you think we can go with this? Where, you know, how extreme? Because in America, you guys seem to have communes and you have places where you get together loads of land. England, I don't think is quite like that unless you're quite wealthy, because like our land is like super expensive. And I'm sure there are some communes out there, but at the same time, it's like leaving your creature comfort seems quite hard. So what do you see from a local American point of view, and what do you think globally we can do if we're trying to, I hate this term, escape the matrix. It just makes me blah inside, but that seems to be the common term people keep using. How do you escape the matrix now in this 2023 world?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think we'll ever escape it. And I think having a kid is a real challenge, because you're going to be met with this conundrum of wanting your kid to be as healthy and, you know, sort of free of all that toxic consciousness as possible. And yet, on the other hand, you're raising a kid to live in the world that exists, right? Not some fictional world that you wish existed. So you're always going to have that thing where he comes home from school and says, you know, come on, Dad, everybody else has, you know, the chip embedded in their forehead. How am I supposed to communicate with them if I don't have a chip embedded in my forehead? Dad, come on. You know, so I don't know. That's one of the reasons I don't have kids, is I never could really figure out, you know, how to square that circle. But I do think that the only way to really get any relief from the dominant narrative is with other people. You can't, I mean, I guess you could go off and, you know, be a Unabomber kind of figure in the middle of nowhere and just, you know, live off rabbits or whatever. But I think that by far the best way to do it is with other people and forming some community. And I mean, land is an issue, but I do know land in Spain is cheaper than in the U.S. And certainly buildings are. And a lot of Europe, I don't know about the U.K., but a lot of Europe, the villages have emptied out. And so you can buy a whole village for €100,000 or something, and, you know, just get all your friends, get a few friends together and go and rehabilitate the village. I had this plan years ago when I was living in Barcelona. I wanted to raise some money and buy a village up in the Pyrenees and, you know, set up like a satellite high-speed internet connection and, you know, renovate a couple of houses that I would live in and my friends would live in. And then, you know, as we sort of got the place going again, other people could come in and, you know, we'd sort of choose like, okay, we need a doctor and a carpenter and, you know, certain kind of figures that we need in the community, and sort of rebuild a community in this medieval village. You know, like most of my ideas, it never really amounted to anything, but I still think it's a great idea. And I think, I think it's viable. If I were in my 20s, that's probably what I'd be looking at this point. Because Europe is full of opportunities like that. You know, beautiful old villages with incredible views and, you know, spring water. And just like, I was looking at places in southern Spain. I was there about a year ago. And like, it's amazing what you can buy for $100,000 to $200,000. And, you know, that's not a lot of money when you got 5-6 couples together or something pooling money. So I do think the opportunities exist. And I think the best way to do it is with other people. I think, you know, like with many things, we need to learn from the people who went before us. And one of the things we need to learn is that, you know, you need to sort of establish boundaries and be really clear about how decisions are going to be made and anticipate, you know, problems and changes and things. And it's not just the whole, like, you know, free love back to the land 1968 again. You know, we need to learn from the failures of those days. Just like we are with, you know, psychedelics and, you know, and other, you know, like there's a big difference between the dialogue around ethical non-monogamy, for example, that's now, you know, compared to the whole kind of, you know, love the one you're with, free love, 1969, you know, if it feels good, do it mentality, right? Like there's definitely a more like, okay, wait a minute, you know, that brought us all sorts of problems that we don't need to deal with again. So let's, you know, the pendulum, every time the pendulum swings, it feels like we need to remember what we learned on the last swing, you know, on this swing. Let's, like, yeah, psychedelics can be very useful. They can be very healing, but they can also be oversold. They can be destructive. They can trigger psychosis. You know, there are all sorts of downsides that were denied the first time. And this time that we need to sort of incorporate into our understanding.
Mm. On the pendulum swing, I was thinking of you there actually in terms of you seem to be quite settled at the moment from what I can gather. You got your house and you're in a nice location. And I've struggled with this pendulum swing of travel versus like base. And like, you know, I got rid of everything a couple of years ago, sold the car. Grown with a dog, you know, went traveling, really missed having a base, and saw all my friends getting houses, come back, get a house, have a baby. It's like, shit, I want to go traveling again now. How do you deal with that pendulum swing? Where are you on that right now? Because it feels like you're kind of secured at the moment in one location. Do you think that's where your plans to be for the next few years? What's going on with you there?
Yeah, I think that. You know, when we're young, I feel like we look for answers. And as I've gotten older, I have realized that there aren't as many answers as I thought. That actually what happens is you just sort of stop asking the question. So by that, what I mean is, the way you frame the question contains the answer. So if you frame the question as like, I love traveling, but then when I'm traveling, I love not traveling. And then when I'm not traveling, I want to travel. If you frame it that way, then you're sort of in this bifurcated back and forth, never where you want to be situation. Whereas if you frame it as there's a balance to those two things that is you know, that is composed of a little dissatisfaction with wherever I am, and you just sort of understand that that's the nature of life, then I think things get easier. It's like when you're hungry, you want to eat, but then when you've eaten, you miss the hunger. You know, when you're in a relationship, you remember how great it was to live alone. And then when you're living alone, you miss being in a relationship. You know, it's like, that's just, it's night and the stars are fantastic, but it's fucking cold. And then in the day, it's warm, but where are the stars? You know, it's like, that's the nature of life. It's always yes, this, but no to that. It's always like that. So I feel like whether I'm traveling or I'm not traveling doesn't really matter as much as it used to. You know, I think of this line from Chogyam Trungpa, who was a Tibetan Buddhist teacher and writer who spent a lot of time in this little town in Colorado where I am right now. In one of his books, he talks about how Westerners have a sense of enlightenment, which is wrong, because we think that enlightenment is this state of constant bliss and wisdom, and you just, you know, you're there, you're in nirvana, you know. And he said that's a total misunderstanding of the term that's actually in these Tibetan Buddhist texts. He said the better translation is balance. And he said true enlightenment is when no matter how good your life is, you don't forget the suffering that's happening all around you. And no matter how bad your life is, you don't forget the beauty that's all around you. And he says something, I'm paraphrasing, but he says, life is joyful participation. No, not life. Enlightenment is joyful participation in the sorrows of the world. Right? So I think that's the point. 'Cause I feel like when I'm not traveling externally, I'm still traveling internally. I'm reading, I'm thinking, I'm changing, I'm growing, I'm meeting new people, I'm trying new things. And then when I'm traveling externally, I don't have as much time or energy for trying those new things, right? Like this guitar behind me, I'm sort of in the very early stages of learning to play guitar, right? I couldn't do that if I were backpacking around South America, you know? So there are different ways of travel and different ways of being stable. And so to me, it doesn't really matter if I'm on the road or I'm home. It's seeking that balance between the familiar and comfortable and the new and the challenging, sort of always having them a good balanced mix of those two things. Then I'm happy, whether I'm on the road or I'm not.
Yeah. I like that. I think I just get a bit of cabin fever because we were here for pandemic and then first 6 months of the baby didn't really move. But then we went the other way. So we drove to Poland from the UK. That was like 4 days. It wasn't that bad. And then we ended up going to Thailand with a baby and the in-laws. But then by the time I got home, I came back here and I was like, it'd been 3.5 months. And I was like, I was so grateful to come back. I was like, there's an album by a Welsh band called Stereophonics. I don't know if they're very big in the US. So they're a pretty big band over here. And their album is called You Have to Go There to Come Back. And I always like that line. I was like, right. So true. Like, I had to go there to come back to go, oh, I'm really grateful for this house. I'm really grateful for the ability to cook my own meals and have my mother-in-law do it for me and all those things. So yeah, I know what you mean. There's definitely a balance to it. But I feel like it's a bit like anything. We get stuck in one side. And then you get a bit itchy and you might jump in 2 feet the other way too quickly. So it's like, yeah, keeping that like constant ebb and flow of travel and
slow it down.
So what are you planning? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think slowing it down is an important part of it, you know, like we were saying earlier, you know, when we're hungry, we want to eat and then we eat and we miss the hunger. Well, I don't think the key to that is to like stop eating. You know, or to fast for a week or whatever. I mean, that can have value as well. But I think the key is eat slowly and really enjoy it, right? Like, really don't just eat to fill your stomach, eat and like, this is good and it tastes good and I'm chewing it and like focus on that, because that transition is where the real pleasure is, right? It's so when you come home, like try to savor being home for as long as you can before you just accept it and like, okay, now I need more stimulation, right? I feel like that internal shifting and framing is so important. I was just talking with a friend this morning about, you know, we were talking about how anxiety and excitement are basically the same thing, just framed differently, you know, like, okay, you're rock climbing and you're roped in and you're hanging 50 feet above the ground. Is that exciting or terrifying? It's totally a question of perspective, right? Like how do you choose to experience that feeling? It's the same feeling. It's the same adrenaline, heart rate, blood pressure, you know, on a physiological level, it looks exactly the same. So it's all about your perspective. And perspective, you know, we were talking about a friend whose life is really awesome right now. And she's framing it in terms of grievance over how bad it was before. So like her life has gotten much better in the past few years. And instead of being like, fuck, this is great, I'm so fucking into this, I'm so happy, I'm so lucky, the way she's looking at it sometimes is like, man, that really sucked before. You know, like I should have had a better childhood, or I should have had, you know, this or that. It's exactly the same experience. It's just how are you choosing to frame it? You know, that's the only power we really have, but it's a massive power.
Yeah. It is. This is something that's very close to my heart at the minute. I just finished a book called Gap and Gain by a guy called Dan Sullivan. And the short story of that is, like, most people get stuck in the gap. They've got these ideals of the future. And he says it's a bit like the horizon, the ideals, they're not a reality. And you think, I need to be here. And so you're constantly comparing yourself to the gap of where you think you should be. And he says where a lot of joy comes from is looking at the gains. Like, where have I come from? Where was I a year ago or 10 years ago? And he said the people that tend to spend their time in that section tend to be happier. And when I was in your neck of the woods, so I flew into Denver a couple of months ago, went off to Thermopolis. We did this thing called Vivation, which is like the second oldest breathwork modality. And one of the stories they tell in there is the King's Cup Bearer, which I'm sure you've heard of this thing before. It's like the king had a guy, and his job, or girl, their job was to test the wine before the king drank it. And so that wine might be poisonous. And so they're getting that wine, and they're looking for poison, and they're tasting the wine, and they don't die, and they pass the cup to the king, and he just obviously necks the wine back. It's the same cup of wine. It's the same liquid, it's the same cup, but the perspective, the context is completely different. One thinking it might kill me, the other was thinking, what a delicious cup of wine. And obviously there's loads of examples like that, but I've been thinking about that a lot recently. And one of the methodologies, or one of the principles from this particular breathwork, is enjoy this moment as much as possible, which on its surface doesn't sound like much, but when you go deep down that and you explore that, it's really powerful. Enjoy this moment as much as possible. And we're not like you say, we're distracted and we're looking at different things, but some very, very powerful stuff. So I was, have you been up to Thermopolis out of interest? Have you explored that neck of the woods?
No, I don't think I have. It's in Colorado?
It's where all the ferns are. It's Wyoming. So about 8 hours from you, I think. It's quite close to Yellowstone. It's about 3 or 4 hours from Yellowstone, but you've got all these big natural thermal baths there full of minerals and different things. And we were doing breath work in the water and doing like a little retreat out there. It's really beautiful. I mean, I've not seen much of Middle America before. I've only been to New York City. But yeah, loved it out there. So nice.
Yeah, well, we go up through there pretty regularly. So I've been very close to that. We go up and do a workshop in Montana the last few summers. And so we go through Wyoming. It's awesome. I see it. I'm looking on the
really
map.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, where I live, there are like 5 or 6 hot springs right around within you know, 15 miles or so. Yeah. So there's a lot of hot springs.
This is very
here.
Exotic for me. Yeah, no, it's great. Talk to me a bit about the stopping of the drinking, because I don't know, when I have my perception of you, it's like, oh, I'm gonna have a beer with Chris, we're gonna chill out, have a couple of beers together. So what I heard you talk about on a couple of your podcasts, what was the kind of catalyst of making you think I'm gonna stop drinking for a bit? What led to that?
Well, it's interesting. So I'm 61, I'll be 62 in February. And so a year and a half ago, my partner Anya and I decided to spend a year traveling around the world, sort of celebrate my 60th birthday, you know, just cruise around. We didn't have a house or an apartment or anything. So it was basically kind of just pay rent somewhere or, you know, get Airbnbs in Thailand and Tanzania and Georgia or whatever. And it cost wise, it was almost the same. So I was like, let's spend a year traveling. And so we cruised around the world and, I don't know. I kept thinking, like, I had this sort of recurrent thought of like, maybe I should stop drinking. Cause I recognize that the cost benefit analysis wasn't great anymore. Like I didn't feel any kind of buzz really from alcohol. I just kind of, if I drank beyond a certain point, I just got tired and wanted to go to bed. But I've never been that kind of like, whoa, let's go crazy kind of, you know, drinker. It was never, let's go get in a fight and, you know, drive through red lights. Like I was never that guy, you know. I was just as careful and kind of, you know, I guess I don't have a lot of inhibitions. So getting disinhibited doesn't really change me much. I don't know how to explain it, but, so I was just kind of like feeling like, okay, I know this is not great for my body and I've been doing this since I was in my 20s and I'm not really seeing the upside. I'm just kind of doing it out of habit. And I noticed that I was looking for mechanisms like, you know, I'll only have 5 drinks a week and I'll decide where I'm going to have them. And, or I'll only have 1 beer a day because that first beer really tastes good, but then the second beer is not as much as, you know, whatever. Or I'll only have wine with dinner and, you know, not after dinner and not before dinner, whatever. I was trying to make all these, setting up these games and stuff. And, you know, and they didn't last very long until I was like, no, fuck it. I'll have some more wine after dinner. Or, you know, that first beer was great. I'm going to have another one and another one. And why not? And so I started feeling like, I don't know if I have a drinking problem per se, but I definitely, there's a conflict between what I want to be doing and what I'm actually doing, you know? And, so we came when we were in Georgia, which is a big wine culture. And, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm in Georgia. I'm going to drink some wine in Georgia. You know, it's the famous. But then we decided, okay, we were in Georgia, Greece, and Spain. And that's a lot of wine in those three places. And so we thought, okay, when we get back to the U.S., let's take a month off. And so Anya and I agreed to do that. And also another part of it is Anya is much younger than me and she doesn't really drink. She just drinks if I'm drinking. So I was also feeling like, you know, I'm kind of like dragging her into my vice here in a way that, you know, could impact her health as well. Anyway, so we came back to the U.S. and we stopped. We didn't drink at all. And then I got COVID right away, after avoiding it for a year, traveling all over the world in airports and, you know, buses. And I get back to LA and I went to an ancestral health symposium and I got COVID within days. And so then, then we went up to Montana to do that workshop that I was telling you about in Whitefish. And I had recovered from the COVID and we went up to do the workshop. It was maybe a week or 2 weeks after I was testing negative for COVID. And I don't know what exactly happened, but I started to get really sick. And I was like, shivering under blankets and sweating. And I was having all sorts of issues. And went to a doctor and the doctors ran all these tests. And basically they said, like, your liver is fucked up. Like, you need to not drink anything for 3 or 4 months and then get this tested again because this doesn't look right. And, you know, my father had liver cancer. He had a liver transplant when he was in his mid-60s, so roughly my age. And I think it just kind of like scared the shit out of me, basically, and really put me in a place where I was like, oh, you know, maybe, you know, it's not far-fetched to think I might have liver cancer and I might be dying and I might, you know, be, you know, especially because of my dad's medical history and all that. So it just put me in a place where, you know, these things, these thoughts that had been very sort of abstract and, you know, mental games were very much like, oh, this is real life. And so I didn't drink for 3 months. And honestly, it was a non-issue. It was not a struggle. It was nothing. It was just like, oh, okay, I'm not drinking now. And I started feeling better. And, you know, I didn't show any signs of liver failure or damage or anything. You know, the whites of my eyes didn't turn yellow and, you know, the different signs of discoloration in urine and all these different things. None of that was happening. And because of the American medical system is such a shit show, it took me a while to get the paperwork lined up and insurance and all that so I could actually go to the doctor and get these liver tests. And by the time I did it, it was more like a year later. And the doctor was like, yeah, well, of course your liver was messed up. You had COVID. We know that COVID, you know, has lasting effects, you know, for a month or two after on the liver. And I don't know why they scared you like that, because, you know, it's totally expectable that your numbers would have been like this. And anyway, your liver's totally fine now and there's no problem and, you know, forget about it. Which I guess was a relief, although by that point I was already feeling like, yeah, I don't think there's anything seriously wrong here. But yeah, that was a few months ago and it's weird. I just don't feel any, it's a weird thing. Like, there are a couple of bottles of wine downstairs. I just don't open them. You know, I'm not really tempted or it's not a, like an addiction issue. And that's one of the reasons I haven't talked about it a lot on the podcast, because I kind of feel like there's not much of a story here. It was just like, I don't know. It's like you spend, I remember when I was, I'm obviously much older than you. When I grew up, seatbelts didn't really exist when I was a kid, or they might've been there, but most people didn't wear them, you know? And then I was 16. I remember I was 16 and I was taking my sister to horseback riding lessons after school one day. And we got in the car and my girlfriend was with us and my sister was in the back seat. And my girlfriend went to put on the seatbelt and the thing didn't go in the receptacle. And normally I would have just been like, whatever, who cares? But for some reason, I thought I was being funny, and I was like, no, we're not going anywhere until your seatbelt works, you know? And I went off on this whole rant, and there was a penny stuck up inside it. And we like got the penny and, you know, got a screwdriver and got the penny out. And then she put her seatbelt on. And then we went to drop off my sister, and I lost control of the car and drove through a bridge and landed in a river. And this whole fucking thing happened. And I remember when we hit the it was like a stone wall over the, you know, the side of the bridge. When we hit that, I remember feeling like that feeling you get, like if you're on a roller coaster or something, where the straps are holding your body in and you feel it and you're like, oh, if this weren't here, I'd be flying through the air right now. I remember having that feeling, and nobody got hurt. The car was totaled. It was, you know, embarrassing and ridiculous. But I've worn a seatbelt every day since then. Just like, no, you know, no question. It's not a hassle. It's not an imposition. I've had the experience of knowing what it's like to hit a rock wall at 40 miles an hour and have the seatbelt save your life. So it's no longer a thought process. And I think maybe that's what it's like with the alcohol. It's like, I know what it's like to think, fuck, do I have liver cancer like my dad at this age? My dad, who had just died a couple of years earlier, like shit was very real there for a while.
Yeah.
And that's all it took.
Well, yeah, something very visceral, isn't it? And benefit of you getting COVID at that time. You know, I often trick myself and think, oh, you know, the blue zones, they drink loads of red wine and they're so happy and it's a net positive, really. But this year's been the least I've drank, and that's purely of having the baby and having such little sleep. I don't have the guts to like ruin that little bit of sleep even further with like a glass or two of wine. I just haven't got the ability. But that has also done the same thing. It's like, oh, I've been trying to cut down on alcohol for years, you know, since I was, you know, a teenager, and this has been pretty easy. And again, don't miss it. I had a couple of beers last night. Terrible mistake. Had terrible sleep. Just a few left over from a party. I was like, don't want to go anywhere near those again now. I feel rotten today. Last question for you, because I know we've got to end now. What brings you joy, or what makes you hopeful about humanity? Is there one thing you can leave us on that's like, oh, I've seen this recently, I've been thinking about this? We've got so much doom and gloom going on around us at the minute. Is there anything that stands out as a bit of a shining light for you?
Well, you know, I think it kind of comes back to what we were talking about earlier with the paradise built in hell, you know, the disaster sociology. And I feel like a lot of what motivates me to write books or articles or even my podcast or whatever is the understanding that human beings evolved to take care of one another. That's really what we're good at. You know, if you look at Homo sapiens in the context of other species, there aren't a lot of things that we're uniquely good at, right? We're not fast, strong, you know, we can't build amazing structures with just our hands the way termites and ants can, you know, like, there are certain things we're good at, tools, whatever, technology, but, you know, I kind of feel like we create technology that then turns back, as we were saying earlier, and may, you know, eliminate us. But I feel like what we're best at is taking care of one another, loving each other, feeling compassion for one another. And so in a sense, the doom and gloom makes me hopeful, because I feel like a lot of the things that are collapsing are things that actually separate ourselves from one another and separate us from a better life. And you know, one of the things that, that people don't understand is that it's true that every civilization that's ever existed has collapsed. That is true. And there's no reason to think that this one won't as well. But what people don't understand is that for most people who lived in those civilizations, whether we're talking about ancient Greece or Rome or Sumeria or the Mayans or the Aztecs or the Incas, most people's quality of life went up when that civilization collapsed, right? The quality of life that went down was the quality of life of the ruling class, of the literate, the ones who, you know, if there was a literate class, as with the, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, the ones who recorded things, they recorded a time of apocalypse and horror. But if you talk to the guy living in the countryside who had a small farm with his family and his friends and his little community, his experience was probably like, this is fantastic. Those guys aren't coming around collecting taxes anymore. They're leaving us alone. There are no more invading armies coming back and forth, you know, fighting over God knows what that we get caught in the middle of. The quality of life for most people goes up when the shit hits the fan. So I think that's where I find my hope. It's I don't know if that's what you're looking for, because it's kind of a dark optimism, but that's all I've got.
It's good. You know, my partner's Polish, and she, you know, even after the USSR felt, Poland got better, like, a lot quicker, you know, and that's obviously a small version of what you're talking about.
But exactly.
They prospered a lot. So, Chris, it's always a pleasure talking to you. We're so grateful for everything you do. Keep doing what you're doing. Yeah, very grateful for your time. And I will link everything down below in the show notes so people can find your amazing podcast and your links and all that good stuff. Any final messages for us before we depart?
No, I just want to congratulate you on how great everything's going for you. Your podcast is thriving. Your family is growing. You're a dad. I mean, I don't know how long you and I have known each other, but I feel like you've been on an upward trajectory over the past few years that's really gratifying and beautiful to watch.
Thank you, mate. It's I feel like the luckiest man in the world, you know, escaping the corporate rat race and doing this. And a huge part of that's thanks to you and people like Rogan and listening to you and your travel stories off in India and Canada, singing the Flintstones song in your head and all that sort of stuff. All that sort of the impact that has is freaking incredible. So, but thank you. And it's been great. So, one day we will meet in person, my friend, and have a non-alcoholic beer together. That's my goal at some point.
Yeah, well, that's been a cool. Big help, actually. I don't know what's happening in the UK, but there's some beers here in the US, non-alcoholic, and it tastes the same. It really tastes good. And so it's like the easiest thing ever to stop drinking alcohol if beer's your thing, you know?
Yeah, very quickly, I'll just tell you, I bought a 4-pack of beer years ago, and I was playing PlayStation. And I had 3 of the 4 beers and I felt a bit tipsy. And I thought, I'm not going to have any more now. My wife has come back from work, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, put the beers in the fridge, go to bed. Next day, I go downstairs. There's 0 alcohol beers. And yet my brain thought I was a bit drunk. And so there's something, some weird connection there. Anyway, Chris, thank you for your time, mate. I'm going to be respectful of your time and I'll speak to you very soon. Take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thank you so much for sticking all the way through to the end of the podcast. It really means a lot to me because most people will have dropped off by now. So the fact that you're here at the end means the absolute world to me. And I just want to say a huge thank you for giving me your attention. And my question to you is this: what are you taking from that podcast forward? And the reason I ask that is I heard from a guy called Alex Hormozy a little while ago. He says, you know, if you're watching all these podcasts about health, wellness, business, and you don't take action, then it's just like watching a movie. And I thought, oh, bloody hell, that's me. How many things have I listened to and just forgot and moved on to the next shiny thing? And so let's just take a moment and go, what did we just learn from here? What will I do different from this podcast that I can put into action immediately that's going to help maybe improve my life? So just take a moment to think about that. And if you are looking to deepen your breathwork practice, then why not just click that link below and come and have a look at our Take a Deeper Breath community. It's really good. We've got really great people in that. I'm bringing in guests. It's a monthly commitment. You can cancel anytime. We've tried to keep the price as low as possible. We're bringing in wonderful people. I go live almost every single day to teach a breathing class, which keeps all of us accountable. And there's a load of other stuff going on as well. So the link is down below. I hope to see you in the Take a Deep Breath community. So we have bonuses if you join us now as well. And as always, to finish off this podcast, we're going to do a breathing exercise. So get nice and comfy, and I'm going to jump us into a breathing exercise now so we can chill out, relax, and then afterwards come and join me in the community. Cheers.
Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's breathing exercise has a genuine emphasis on gratitude, and we're going to be using heart coherence breathwork as our breathing vehicle to increase our feeling of gratitude, a wonderful state that we all would like to experience more. So for this exercise, heart coherence breathwork is an inhale through the nose of 5.5 seconds and then an exhale out through the nose for another 5.5 seconds. I've worked with a wonderful musical artist that's put together the music for us for this exercise. So you're going to get the signal with a piano when to breathe in and when to breathe out, which means if you want, you can just close your eyes and just go along with the wonderful music. Now, just a couple of bits about this exercise. What I invite you to do here is take one hand and put it over your chest where your heart is. Because just the sheer action of putting a hand over your chest is incredibly powerful, and knowing that just a few centimeters under there is this wonderful organ that keeps you alive. And then take the second hand and put it on your belly. Because when we're breathing in, it would be wonderful if we can stick that belly out. Maybe imagine that there's a balloon inflating inside the belly. And feel that warm air as it comes in through the nose, and feel your hand as it starts to stick out. And then when you breathe out through the nose, feel the hand come back in again. Because just these actions alone can be very powerful when it comes to mindfulness and meditation, and gives you something else to focus on. Now, I hope you enjoy this exercise. I'd always encourage you as well to think about your intentions before we go into it. So what are some of the things that maybe you want to feel gratitude for today? Is it family members? Is it friends? Is it just the sheer fact that you woke up this morning and got this gift of today? So have a think about what it is that you're most grateful for. Put the hands where they need to be and enjoy this exercise. Thank you so much. Here's the exercise.